everybody, welcome back to another round of Ask Joe. This is Ask Joe number 32 as a part of the Home Studio Corner podcast. I am Joe Gilder, your host, and I'm glad you're here. This episode's coming to you a couple of days late. It'll be hitting you on Friday instead of Tuesday. I've been out of town celebrating or going to visit my newly born niece, Finley, and down in Mississippi where my family's from. And she's terribly adorable and really cute. So it was good to see family and get down there, but that postponed things. Then there was the 4th of July, and then my wife had minor dental surgery today. So just been a big week for us. And get this, tomorrow, it's Thursday night I'm recording this. Tomorrow I will be receiving shipment on a new guitar. And I am sure I will be telling you all about it, but I'm finally going to be an owner of a Les Paul. So here's to that. I'll tell you more about that in the future, and I'm sure I'll put up pictures. And she's gorgeous. I got her from Sweetwater. Haven't named her yet, but I'm told that's what I'm supposed to do. So more on that to come in the future. But needless to say, I'm sitting here wanting to record the podcast, but also wanting tomorrow to get here so that I can see my beautiful guitar. Anyway, so let's just dive into questions. I've got a bunch here that I will try to get to as many as I can and make this another, hopefully, helpful and successful podcast for you. First up is Alex from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Alex writes in relation to or asking about mastering individual tracks. And he says, "Hey, Joe, the way that mastering has typically been presented to me is that you take a collection of completed mixes and do some final editing to them as a whole to create an album from those songs. What about individual songs? I'm just recording and releasing a single. Is there no mastering, or does it cover more than what is described above? Would there be a fine line between mixing and mastering processes in this case?" This is a really good question and a really appropriate question, because what I'm seeing just from my small little circle of influence and the people that I interact with and selling my own music online is that we've definitely moved away from an album age to a single age. Meaning people are, just from my perception, people are buying a lot more single songs than they are albums. Now, I personally like to buy albums still, but looking at just the sales of my album that I put out a couple of years ago, sold many more of just individual songs than I did actual album, full album sales. So that's interesting. So this question of what is mastering, do we even do mastering if we're talking about singles? Does it apply? Is a very good question. So thanks for asking that, Alex. I would say, in answer to your definition, or what the definition that you've come to understand of mastering, I would say that's not complete. Mastering is taking all the mixes of an album and putting them together. But you mentioned editing. It's not really editing at all. It's a process of kind of mixing those songs. So you do, typically in the appropriate or the accepted way, is you mix your songs, and generally those mixes are going to be at low volume, and you use mastering to bring up that volume using things like limiting, multiband compression, and to bring that volume up to a nice standard level. And then you're also doing other things. EQing an entire mix is very different from EQing the individual tracks in a mix. And both are usually necessary in the process of a song. So mastering, to me, there's a little part of it that's just making sure the songs flow together. They're all the same basic volume, and the gaps between songs make sense, all of that. But that's just a small part of it to me. The biggest part of that is taking this finished mix and polishing it and getting it ready for mass consumption, meaning making sure it's going to sound good on as many systems as I can, making sure that it's at a nice loud volume so that it won't be so much quieter than everything else in a person's library that they're listening to, and just making it nice and loud. There's nothing wrong with a loud mix. Making it too loud and using too much limiting and compression is certainly a bad thing. But that's one of the big fun parts of mastering a song, is getting to just slap some compression on there if it needs it and getting that thing nice and loud. So that is more what mastering is about. If you want to check out more on that, I've got a couple of blogs on articles on my site about it. You can check out the multiband compression webinar that I did with Ian Shepherd. You can find that at multibandcompression.com. And Ian Shepherd himself actually just released a mastering course that is pretty awesome. And you can find more about that on my website as well. It's somewhere in there. I'll put some links in the show notes for that as well. I'm not sure if currently he's accepting new students, but I think he might be. Either way, if you really want to get into mastering and learn it from a pro who's been doing it forever, he'd be your man to look to. But that's my longer answer to your nice and short question. Okay, next up is Mitch from Ramsey, New Jersey. This is about a computer upgrade. Mitch writes, I've been experiencing lots of software crashes on my larger projects. I can't even use Reason through Rewire for more than 5 minutes without a crash. Currently, I'm using a 2.53 gigahertz Intel Duo Core MacBook Pro with 4 gigs of RAM and external hard drive. After spending a few months looking at options, my research has led me to conclude that a new and more powerful computer is the solution. I'm looking for a refurb Mac Pro with 16 gigs of RAM, 2 hard drives. Any advice you have to offer would be great. Well, Mitch, it really depends on what you're doing. For me, I've yet to crash or choke any of my computers that I've owned. But the songs and the projects that I'm usually working on are mostly audio. So I'm not doing much in the way of sequencing and any sort of virtual instruments. I do use them, but they're not the bulk of my tracks. So the bulk of my tracks are actual audio tracks of recorded things. So for me, using a bunch of plugins on a mix has never been that issue. So I might not be able to help you. I've got a system similar to the one you described. I've got one of the, it's not a terribly new iMac with 4 gigs of RAM, I believe. Actually, I'll look it up now while I'm talking to you. But it was the cheapest iMac that I could get at the time. Yes, it's a 3.06 Core 2 Duo with 4 gigs of RAM. So, and I'm able to do a lot with that, and I don't really hit any limits. So I would say it could be that you need a new computer, but I wrote an article about this just this week about, you know, people like Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, they would have killed to have the capabilities that we have now. So I hate to see people are saying they need this or that to make good music. I would say, yes, it sounds like you're having issues, but I would wonder if there are other things you should be doing than looking at a new computer. Perhaps if you've got a lot of virtual instruments, maybe just bounce those down to a stereo track and disable the instrument. That'll save a bunch of space on your computer and give you room to work. That would be my advice. I would get the computer as a last resort, because the next computer you get, you'll find a way to max out those resources. So figuring out a good way to take a look at the way that you work in your studio and in your projects and see if there are things you are perhaps doing that are overkill. Maybe you're using too many plugins. Are you putting 6 plugins on every track? That might not be necessary from a computer resources standpoint, but also from a mix and just sound standpoint. Maybe it doesn't sound that good to have all those plugins. Obviously, I don't know how your mixes look and what you're working on, so these suggestions might not be helpful for you. But in general, for anybody listening, a computer is not always going to be the answer. And because a faster computer isn't going to be tons faster than one you currently have, and I'm just a big fan of looking for other ways to make your projects work better than just buying something else. So that's, if it was me, that's what I would do. Next up is Conrad from Ireland, and Conrad is asking about electric guitar technique. It says, I'm wondering what your favorite technique for recording an electric guitar is. Is it ADT, I'm not sure what that is, real double tracking, or splitting the signal into pseudo stereo via 2 different speaker emulators, or recording the signal directly from a cabinet with 2x2 mics. Sorry, there's some typos here. I can't read it as well. Which one would be most common, would you mostly recommend to get a nice stereo sound of distorted electric guitars? Okay, so he's asking of which way do I record to get a nice stereo sound of electric guitars? Do I double track them? Do I use a single track and just use different amp simulators on 2 copies of the same track to get a stereo image? Or do I use 2 different microphones on the guitar cabinet? And the answer is you really can't. Think about it for a second. A guitar amp, an amp is usually a single speaker or a couple sets of speakers if it's like a 410 cabinet. But it's essentially one source. There's no left or right to a guitar cabinet. It's one source. Emulating sound is emanating from one spot generally. So that source itself is not stereo. There's no way you can make that stereo. You can put 2 mics on it and try to make it a little wider. You could do like he's talking about and double the signal, you know, copy the track over to a new track, pan them left and right, and really dramatically process each side differently, and that'll give you maybe a little more separation. But again, it's not a stereo signal. Stereo means there are 2 sources. So for example, an acoustic guitar is a single instrument, but it's a wide instrument. The sound is emanating from the neck, from the fretboard, from the body, from the sound hole, from the back of the guitar. So you can put two microphones on it and get a stereo signal. With a guitar amp, you can do that a little bit. If you put it out in the room and are getting more of the sound of the room, that could give you a little bit of a stereo signal. But if you're talking about a nice, wide, super wide sound, you've got a double track. There's just really no other way that I found that does that. Everything else it could work and give you a cool sound, but it's not going to sound super stereo or super wide, because it's at the end of the day, you're talking about a mono signal that you're trying to fake into stereo. So track the thing twice, pan those left and right, and you'll have a nice wide sound. One thing to note with heavily distorted guitars is you want to dial back the distortion. If you record a bunch of distorted tracks, once you blend them all together, there's essentially this white noise that happens. It's not very pleasant and just makes everything sound bad. So cleaner tone generally gives you bigger guitar sound. All right, next up is Danny from Holland. We are jumping all over the globe. Danny says, when you have your tracks in your DAW, what do you do first, second, third, etc., up to the final project? Or the final product? That is a loaded question. And it's in regards to mixing. So when I've got all the tracks, what do I do? Well, I'll try to give the not an hour-long answer. It varies, but here is this with a caveat. This is a general, it's going to change from mix to mix, but in general, this is what I do. I bring up all the faders for all the tracks, and I have no plugins on the tracks at all. All the faders up, everything panned to the center or my mono button engaged, and then I just set levels. I spend as much time as it takes to get a good balanced mono mix. So everything, all the levels set, no plugins anywhere, and have everything balanced nicely, but also make sure that I'm not blowing out the master fader and that the signal of the entire mix isn't too loud. And so that lets me adjust that right from the beginning, so I'm not playing that game later in the mix where I'm starting to clip the master fader and have to bring everything down and it starts to unglue my mix, that whole dance. It's just not fun. So I do an all faders up approach where I have the faders up. I get a nice static mix in mono with no plugins. Then I go from there processing things. So from there, I may mute everything but drums and dial in the drum sound, but I'm usually leaving those faders fairly close to where I put them because that's kind of my gut instinct mix that I'm going to work from. So I'll go to drums, work on overhead, then kick and snare, make sure the phase is right, EQ them all, getting a nice, you know, getting rid of some of the muddiness and the hollowness and dialing in the tones that I want. Then I'll usually compress that drum bus and do compression on some of the individual tracks if they need it. Next, I'll go on to bass, then guitars, any guitar parts, any other rhythm parts, keyboards, pads, any other instruments there. And the last thing I usually do is vocals. So lead vocal is the last thing, and then I do automation runs on everything, and that's generally it. I'm ready to bounce. One thing to note, the first thing I do after I do that static mix I talked about generally is I put a compressor on my master fader. So I do that right at the beginning after I've got a nice balanced mix at the level that I want. I put that compressor on there and have it just knocking off a dB or two just to start gluing that mix together a little bit, maybe a little more, just depending on the song. Then I go and start working on the individual tracks. So it's a cool way of doing it because it tends to make you compress things less because you've got the master bus compressor that is compressing things a little bit, especially like the lead vocal gets, because it's generally the loudest thing in the mix or the most prominent, it gets hit with a good bit of compression just at the master fader. And so then you don't have to do maybe quite as much compression on the individual track because there's already some compression happening on the output. So that's something that I like to do first, then work my way back from there. Next up is Charlotte from British Columbia, Canada, getting closer to home. She has a question about mixing. Says, hey Joe, I know that there's no hard and fast rules, but what are your thoughts about which works best as an insert, EQ or compression? That's a really good question. The boring answer is they're two very different tools that do two very different things. So I can't really say one's better than another. On just any given mix, I'll probably use EQ and compression on a lot of tracks. Some tracks will just get EQ. Some tracks might just get compression. It just depends on what the track needs. So my initial answer is learn how to use both effectively and what they sound like and how you can use those to manipulate the sound to get it to the sound that you want it to have. That said, if I had to choose, between one or the other, if you held a gun to my head and said, mix this song and you can only use EQ or you can only use compression on the tracks, then I would hands down use EQ, because I think EQ is much more useful than compression, because you can compress things, but that's not really going to change the frequency tonal balance of that particular part. So if it's a little muddy and you add everything together, compression's not going to really help with that muddiness. It might actually make it worse. So using EQ, that would be what I would do. Use EQ to get rid of frequencies I don't need in there and to shape everything. And then if the tracks were recorded well and have a nice dynamic to them, then while I would miss compression, I'd be much happier with an all EQ mix than an all compression mix. Great question, Charlotte. Next up is Robert, one of my VIP members. Robert is asking about headphones. He says, what's your recommendation for low to mid-priced studio headphones? There are a lot of reviews and recommendations available, but what do you like? I like, for low to mid-price, the Sennheiser HD 280 Pro headphones. Those are $100. They've always been $100 as long as I've known them. And so that might seem expensive to you. That might seem cheap. But $100 is a good set of closed-back tracking headphones. So they're comfortable. I really don't like the Sonys, the MDR-7506 or any of those. I don't think they're very comfortable. I don't think they sound very good. And I like the Sennheisers. They sit over the ears. They're nice and padded and comfortable, and they sound pretty good. Would I use them for mixing if it's all I had? Yeah, I'd certainly use them. As I've talked about before, I like my HD-650 headphones from Sennheiser, which are more like $500. So those are high-end. But for a good all-around headphone, the HD-280s are great. They have some in-between ones, like the 380, that I believe is around $200, which is maybe an open-back design, a little higher-end headphone, which is worth looking at as well. But anything under $100, I don't have a problem with. I just generally haven't heard anything that sounds all that great, at least in headphones. So that's my answer. Good question, Robert. Next up is Ian from Indonesia, asking about an Inbox 2 or Inbox 3 Pro. He says, hi, Joe. How do I connect the Apogee Big Ben Apogee Rosetta 200 to an Inbox 3 Pro? So you've got a Big Ben, which is a master clock, and a Rosetta 200, which is a two-channel D to A and A to D converter. The Inbox 3 Pro, if I recall, and again, I used to sell this stuff at Sweetwater. I've been out of practice, so I don't keep up with the latest. Unless I'm buying it, I don't really research stuff anymore. It just doesn't interest me that much. But if I recall, the Inbox 3 Pro is a FireWire interface, and it's got mic inputs, line inputs, and I believe, I'm just actually pulling it up on Sweetwater's website, I believe it's got SPDIF digital in and out. And SPDIF is a funny word to say. It's // PDIF. It's just a digital language, a digital format, and it's a two-channel format. So it looks like an RCA connector that you would use for something like a cheap set of speakers or something like that. It's those little RCA connectors, red and white usually, but it's actually a digital connection. So if I'm looking at the Inbox Pro, there it is. Pull up a picture. Yeah, it looks like for digital, it's got SPDIF connection. So a SPDIF is just a two-channel digital connection. So you plug one cable and it carries two channels on it. So that would be how you would connect it to your Rosetta. So the Rosetta is your converter. You'd run from your preamp into the Rosetta and then the digital output of the Rosetta into the Inbox. And yeah, it looks like it's got a breakout cable with that SPDIF connection. So you can only get two extra channels. And then you can run the outputs of the SPDIF output connection out to your Rosetta, which would then convert it back to digital. So you can play back your tracks through your Rosetta as well. The Big Ben just connects to the Rosetta itself using the BNC cable. Now, all that said, I've owned a Big Ben before. I've not heard a huge difference. It's a master clock. It's expensive. And generally, the clock in the Rosetta is really good anyway. The clock in the Big Ben is good, but I just don't know if you'll hear much of a difference. That said, I take it back. The Inbox has word clock connection as well, so I would run a word clock connection from the Big Ben to the Inbox Pro, and then also from the Big Ben to the Rosetta, and let the Big Ben be the master. Now, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, it's really I'm never going to have, I say never. I will probably never own a master clock in my studio again. I don't see any need for it. Personally, in a home studio, I feel like there's many more things I can upgrade before I'm doing that, or even high-end converters probably. So don't feel like you need to understand that, but I would explain it, but I just don't think it really applies to many people. So we'll just move on. Next up is Bill. Bill is a VIP member as well, and Bill's asking about an upfront and punchy mix. Hey, Joe, I have a mix which is my second attempt. First one had a lot of mistakes. My teacher gave me a reference mix he had. I finished mine, which I thought sounded good. I listened to his, and his is so much more punchy and upfront. My kick wasn't very good, so I watched Graham's video about applying a sine wave to make it have more bottom end. But something is missing. Any suggestions? Well, Bill, I honestly don't have much suggestion for you. It sounds like from this email that this is your second mix ever. So I would just say your mix not sounding as good as your teacher, whoever that is completely to be expected. And so there's no magic pill that says, you know, if you do this and this, then bam, your mix is going to be great and you don't have to practice ever again. You're going to have to just finish a mix and go on to the next mix and finish that and just keep moving and moving and moving and doing more mixes. It's just like any other skill. If I emailed you, if you're a golf player, I'm not much of a golfer, but if I said, hey, I just finished playing golf for the second time in a row and my teacher can hit the ball much farther and straighter than I can, what's the problem? You would say, well, the problem is you haven't played enough golf. Keep practicing, keep working at it. So that would be my answer to you. I know it's probably not the answer you were looking for, but it's an honest answer and it's what I would tell myself if I was asking myself the same question. Because there's just so many variables, so many things at play here, but chances are it's your experience level. That's the biggest variable. You mentioned the kick drum. You can do that trick where you add a sine wave and a gate to add more low end to the kick. Unless the kick wasn't recorded well, if there's low end there, you might not need to do that sine wave trick. For me, one trick that I do, and there are very few things that I do regularly on a mix because it just changes from mix to mix, but I'm almost always taking the kick drum and doing a cut around 400 hertz. You have to find the frequency that needs to be cut, but it just sounds boxy at that frequency. So when I cut both kick and toms, tends to sound a lot better. I actually have some audio samples of that on my site, which I will link to in the show notes as well. But that's like my only trick that I almost always do. So maybe that'll help get you in the right direction. Just keep at it, keep working at it, keep having fun with it. Learn new stuff, apply what you learn, and just keep moving forward. Next up is Mike from Trinidad and Tobago. We are traveling the globe today. It's awesome. This is a question regarding room size for the studio. And he says, please provide three room sizes that are recommended specifically for good studio design, small, medium, and large. You know what? I'm not going to give you specifics because I don't know what's exactly a good size. What I can say is I wrote an article about this on my website that I would defer you to. It's probably more than I can cover in the podcast. But generally, a rectangular room is best because you can at least predict how that's going to work. And I'm trying to remember what the rule was. You don't want any dimension of the room. So you've got length, width, and height of a room. You don't want any of those dimensions to be divisible by each other or by the same number, if that makes sense. So in your example, you have a 12 by 8 by 7 foot room. The 12 and the 8 are both divisible by 2 and by 4. And what that means is any issues you have that have a wavelength of 12 feet, of 4 feet, are going to be amplified at 8 feet and also 12 feet. So you're just adding more issues at those frequencies. So an ideal room would be something that is, say, 10 by 11 by 13, for example, where none of those numbers are divisible by each other or by the same number. And that's just a general rule of thumb. I'm not an acoustician. I just know just enough to get moving in the right direction. I generally refer people to Gavin Haverstick at Haverstick Designs. He used to work for RLX and great guy. I'll put a link to his site in the show notes. Just knows a ton and he does a lot of, if you're actually looking to build, it'd be worth hiring him to get with you on the design to make sure you build it the right way. If you want to do that kind of thing, you don't need maybe someone to get specifically help you with designing a room, but you do want to know more about acoustic treatment. Gavin and I ran a webinar training course a couple years ago called Understanding Your Room. And I asked him to come on and do this live training deal where he just went through everything you need to know about doing acoustically treating your home studio. So he talked about the theory behind it so you can understand what's happening with the sound waves and why treatment's important and what how to even wrap your head around what's happening so you can make good decisions on how to treat your room. And then he goes into practical applications of measuring your room, figuring out what frequencies you need to make sure you are absorbing, how low your treatment needs, what the lowest frequency you need to be absorbing in your treatment, all that kind of stuff. Really good stuff. It's obviously, it's a drier subject. It's not as fun or exciting as miking up a guitar cabinet or talking about mixing, things like that. But it's certainly important because acoustic treatment is just one of the, it's one of the probably most overlooked parts of recording, but it's really important that you at least consider it and think about it when you're working through you're setting up your studio or trying to get better sound out of your studio. So you can check that out if you want to look at that class. It's at understandingyourroom.com. Understanding, YOURROOM.com. Worth checking out. Good question. Okay, next up is Rick from New York. And Rick is asking about monitors. It says, what's your opinion regarding Equator Audio D5 monitors? Comparing sound quality to price? Sounds like a good deal. Would you buy it and why? Well, I'm not familiar with those particular ones. I'm bringing it up now on my computer to take a look at them. But it, generally, it's any monitor that's made today, and I know this is gonna sound like another cop-out answer, but any studio monitor that's being built today that's not dirt cheap is going to be good. It's going to have a decent sound to it because the technology is just there. There's not many people out there making crappy speakers and selling them for a decent price. Does that make sense? So as long as they're not bottom of the barrel, $150 pair of speakers, you can bet that they're going to sound okay. So for me, if I'll answer this more generally. I like to not get into too much specifics with specific gear if I can, so it can help the most people. And since I don't know those speakers and their website's not coming up, I'll just answer it more generally. With studio monitors, and we're talking about computer speakers, studio speakers, I generally like to go with something that has at least a 5-inch woofer on it. So anything smaller than that just doesn't reproduce the low end well enough. I prefer probably something with a 6-inch to 8-inch, but generally that 5 to 6 is a good range because it's going to have at least enough bass for you to accurately hear what's happening in the low end. You probably won't hear the deep, deep low end, but you can still get by and make a decent mix with something like that. So if it does that and it's a decent sound, you know, a decent price. I know price is maybe not the best thing to judge something on, but if it's really, really cheap, then they couldn't have put really good quality components into it. So I'm not saying spend $2,000 on a set of speakers, but $500 might be a reasonable place to start, and you can go upwards from there. If I were to go out and buy a new set of monitors today, I would probably look at something like, I don't know, the Focal stuff, the CMS speakers, the CMS50 is a 5-inch speaker. It's about $700 a speaker. So those are like $1,400 for the pair. But I like those. I like Genelec and even some of the JBL stuff I've always been somewhat fond of. So hopefully that helps or gets you thinking through that. I wish I could tell you. I've listened to those. And I know what they sound like, but I just haven't. Okay, next up is Mike from Milwaukee asking about speakers again. Says, hey Joe, is it okay to use a pair of Infinity IL-10s for monitors in my studio? I have a PV5050 tube amp that I want to push them with. It only has a resonance and presence knob, so I figure it'll be pretty flat. It has EL84 valves and 12AX7 pres. What do you think about that? Mike, again, this is probably more technical than I'm going to be able to help you with. I don't know what Infinity speakers are, but I do know of professionals, mastering engineers especially, who will use hi-fi non-quote studio speakers in their mastering chain. So they'll use nicer stereo home theater speakers for mastering. So I would say there's no way to know. The fact that it has a resonance and presence knob is in no way is an indication that it's a flat amp by any means. You just have to listen. Maybe look at the specs, but generally just try it. If you've got it there, there's no reason you can't try it. But in general, I've found that audio systems for personal use that aren't really high end, they tend to just want to hype up the lows and the highs to make it sound good. And while that's great for listening to something, you know, making that bass punch a lot louder than it really needs to, and nice sparkly high end, the smiley face curve, as we like to call it. You may think that sounds good to play music through that, but it's horrible to mix through because it's like adding an EQ to your output. So you think there's bass there and there's not, or vice versa. So I would say, if they are truly accurate speakers, go for it. And the worst thing you can do is just try it and it doesn't work. But that's the best way I can answer that. Okay, next up is Jake from Fort Worth, Texas. Says, hey Joe, my question is, when do you think is the best time to share the projects with your clients? Do you ever share after every big stage of the recording process, or just wait and share the mix? Would really love to hear how you go about this. Thanks. That's a good question, Jake. I would say it depends. It's so different on each project. It depends on what I'm doing. If I'm recording and mixing and mastering the project, then I'm probably sharing stuff with them along the way, because they probably want to hear things as we go through the process so they can have ideas for maybe how they want to sing the vocal later on and all that. So I'll send them bounces of stuff if they want them. But I don't like to waste a lot of time doing that, because it takes time to go in and do a quick rough mix and bounce it out and do all that stuff. So if I can and nobody needs to hear it, I'll try to hold off at least until mixing. And when I'm mixing something, I'll generally do, if I'm doing, you know, maybe allocating 4 hours to that mix, I'll do maybe 3 hours worth of mixing, 2 or 3 hours, to where it's fairly done and it's only to do the smaller tweaks, small level adjustments, automation moves, all that stuff. I'll leave that and won't do that yet and send the mix over to get their feedback. Because that's helpful if I went in one direction with the mix and they were thinking it's in a completely different direction. It's nice to get that feedback after only a couple hours of work rather than 4, 5, 6 hours of mixing and then find out it's nothing like they wanted. Now, a lot of that can be avoided by setting expectations and really understanding where they're coming from. But even then, you may just make some creative decisions during mixing that they just want it to sound a different way. And that's totally fine. And you can hopefully save yourself a lot of time by taking the extra time to send them some mixes and getting their approval. Even just to say, hey, this is where I'm at. I've got some more things to adjust, but this is generally going to be the feel of this mix. Let me know if this is okay with you, or if anything is really bothering you, let me know so I can make some changes. Good question. Next up is Brandon from Brighton. I don't know where Brighton is, but great to have Brandon. Says, when someone purchases a good quality audio interface, such as an Apogee or RME, they come with good A to D and D to A built in, meaning analog to digital, digital to analog converters. What's the point of buying a separate converter when more expensive audio interface provide good quality? That's a good question. If you have a good quality audio interface, a more expensive one with good converters, then there's not really a huge reason to go into high-end converters. And like I said earlier, it's just, there are so many more things you can upgrade that will yield bigger results than upgrading just your converters. So upgrading your microphone, your cables, your preamps, your studio monitors, your front end, your back end, anything before converters will probably yield a much more noticeable result, as long as you're using decent converters. If all of that is upgraded and you feel like you've done everything you can to upgrade the sound and you've got acoustic treatment and everything and you're still missing something, then it's either, and I guess assuming that your skills are there and it's not you that's the problem, then it might make sense to upgrade to nice converters. But I generally think in a home studio, you've got plenty of other areas you can spend that money that will give you a bigger payout than just going in and buying new converters. Okay, next up is Miller from Stuttgart, which sounds maybe German. Says, hi Joe, please talk about the new AAX audio plugin format used by Pro Tools. What are the pros and cons, etc.? Take care. You know what, Miller? I'll be completely honest. I don't have Pro Tools 10, and I know nothing about the AAX plugins. So I apologize, but I just don't know anything about it. I knew there was a new plugin format, but I honestly don't know what the benefits are. Like I said, since I don't sell this stuff anymore and I'm not buying Pro Tools 10, I have no reason to study it. So my apologies. Next up is Taylor from the UK asking about hardware compressors. Says, how often do hardware compressors... It's not written very well. How often do hardware compressors break? Do they require maintenance in the long run? What's the shelf life of a hardware compressor? That's a good question. A hardware compressor is going to last much longer than your computer or your audio interface, probably. It's a simpler design. It doesn't have all the digital componentry. You don't have to worry about just simple things like firmware upgrades and if the company will support it in the future. Anything digital is always subject to needing to be upgraded just because it might not work with the next operating system. For example, if you have an older version of Pro Tools and your computer finally dies and you have to buy a new computer and the version of Pro Tools you own doesn't work on that operating system, you've got to pay for that next version. And that's the same with most software out there. A compressor, you just plug it into the system and it works. So as far as maintenance and things like that, sure, I'm sure there will be some maintenance costs on a compressor over years and years. But the hardware stuff that I've owned, I've not really had to maintain at all. I think we're talking years and years down the road. So I wouldn't really let that factor into your decision-making process at all. Next up is Gabe from Lexington, Kentucky. And Gabe's asking about recording and mixing a djembe. It says, "Hey Joe, you've talked about a lot about mixing drums. I've tried to apply that to recording and mixing a djembe, but it's giving me problems in the mixing phase. I recorded it with a kick drum mic underneath and a pencil condenser up top. Any expertise you can give me? Thanks, Gabe." Djembe is difficult. For those of you familiar, it's this big drum, big round head on the top, and a big port on the bottom that lets out the low end. And I would say it's tough. I would probably not use a condenser on the top just because I'd probably treat it more like a snare drum. But I'm not saying that's wrong. That might actually be a better way to go about doing it. One thing you want to make sure from the get-go is that your phase stuff is right. So while you're recording it, you should make sure that you place the mics as in phase as you can, which means flipping the polarity on them, moving them around till you get the best sound, because they're essentially out of phase with each other. One's on the bottom of the drum, one's on the top. So chances are you need to flip the polarity of one of them anyway, just like you would on a top and bottom snare drum mic. But even from there, moving the placement of that bottom one or the top one might dramatically affect the tone. So for example, when he hits that big deep note, if the mics aren't in the right place, that deep note might get canceled out because the mics are interfering with one another and there's phase issues happening. So by getting that mic placement right to begin with, you're off to the right start. So let's say it was recorded properly. At that point, I would try just all sorts of different techniques. Maybe don't treat them as separate microphones and just bust them to one aux track and treat it like one mic. So use compression and EQ and things like that to bring out the snap and the punch of the drum. Or you can treat them separately. I would treat the bottom one much like a kick drum and the top one probably more like an overhead mic, if anything. So you get that nice bottom end with the bottom mic and not much else, and then you get all the snappiness of the top. Other than that, I wish I had more specific examples for you. I haven't done much, if any, mixing of djembe in a long time. So I would say just keep on experimenting. It obviously, the recording process is hugely important. And then after that, keep checking it out and just try different stuff. All right, I've got a bunch more questions here, but my voice is about gone. So I'm going to do one more, and we will call it a night. And maybe catch these on the next one. We'll see. I'm getting lots and lots of questions, so trying my best to keep up. This is a question from Vinny in St. Louis, Missouri. And Vinny's asking about mastering EQ. And he writes, "I was wondering if you could explain why EQ is so important on the master track during the mastering process. Where I'm confused is that you have already EQ'd each individual track to get the tonal balance that you're after. Why does it come into play on the master as well?" That is a great question and a good question to end the podcast on. So I said earlier, answering one of the questions, that EQing an entire stereo mix, is very different from EQing an individual track. And you're right, you do need to EQ the individual tracks to get all the parts to sit together well in the mix. But in general, you may find that even though you took out that boominess in the bass guitar and the kick drum, that the entire mix might still be just a hair bit boomy at a certain frequency. And it could be because of the guitar and the bass and the kick drum and the vocal. They're all just happening to build up at maybe 200 hertz. And you could go in and individually change them, but that would require going back and remixing. And for me, I like to finish the mix. If you're happy with it, be done with it, export it, bounce it, whatever you want to call it, then bring it into a new session for mastering. And then in the mastering session, you may say, it could probably use just a little less at 200 hertz overall, the entire mix. And so just go in and you can move just a dB cut at 200 hertz is actually really noticeable when you're talking about mastering, because everything's running through that EQ. So any subtle change can be pretty obvious. So a dB or two at 200 hertz might just perfectly smooth out that little bit of muddiness that was there. If it's super muddy and bad sounding, then no, you're not going to be able to fix that with EQ and mastering generally. But if it's a good sounding mix and just needs a couple tweaks here and there, that's why you do it. And the best way you can kind of experience that is to just jump in and practice mastering. Pull up a stereo mix and just do some EQ to it and notice how it's a completely different mindset EQing an entire mix versus EQing individual tracks. Generally, with individual tracks, you can be really aggressive. You can jump in there and do, you know, 6 dB cuts and boosts here and there to get the tone that you want. When you're mastering, though, if you do anything dramatic, it generally sounds bad. So you need to do fairly subtle, smooth changes because it's going to affect every instrument, not just a single one. But it's an important part of the process, and it's one of those things you have to kind of hear to start to understand what that's all about. So with that, my scratchy voice is telling me to wrap things up. So thanks again for listening to the podcast and subscribing. This podcast might be changing in the near future. Just the feed in iTunes, it's not really working quite right, and I may need to redo that feed. So you may have to resubscribe to the podcast. I'm not exactly sure how that will work, but to make sure that you don't miss out, if you are only subscribed in iTunes, I would highly recommend subscribing to my daily newsletter over at homestudiocorner.com/newsletter. And I always email out when there's a new podcast and actually do a daily tip every weekday as well. And that way, if you need to resubscribe to the new feed, however that works, you'll know that there's a new episode out there. You don't have to wait for iTunes to find out, because I don't know if they'll automatically do that for me or not. So that's all the housekeeping I had for today. Thanks again for listening. If you have any questions for me that you'd like to be on the podcast, you can send those in at askjoegilder.com. Keep those brief and to the point, and I'll do my best to try to get them in here as a part of a future episode. Again, I'm Joe Gilder from homestudiocorner.com. Thanks for listening. See you on the next podcast.